grn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.
طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح من مخيم إلى بلد مهجر من مخيم إلى بلد مهجر تسكله ماسا لون وطن تسكله ماسا لون وطن نفقا لعودة اللاجئين لعودة اللاجئين وفراش المنفى من شتات
It's just about 8 a.m. You are tuned to Truth and Justice Radio. And any views expressed do not necessarily reflect those of WZBC Boston College or its Board of Trustees. Welcome to the September 7th edition of This Week in Palestine, a weekly show hosted for many years by our beloved chef Sharif Fahm and continued in his memory by a group of his dedicated friends. Every week, This Week in Palestine brings you news and views from a distinctly Palestinian perspective, a perspective seldom heard in the United States. On today's show, we feature two pre-recorded segments. In the first segment, Israeli architect and activist Eyal Weitzman documents how occupation and apartheid is embedded in the architectural of Israel and Palestine. In the second segment, Gazan scholar and BDS activist Haidar Eid presents how Gazans have resisted and opposed Israeli racism and genocide in Palestine. The later segment was recorded in London on April of 2013 and precedes the recent carnage in Gaza, although many of the things described by Haidar are still relevant today. We hope you stay tuned for another thought-provoking edition of This Week in Palestine.
Architecture has always defined the human world, from the simplest structures to the greatest monuments. But a rebellion is underway, led by a new breed of architect that puts people before icons. Architects using the tools of their trade to restructure their surroundings and redefine their profession.
Khayal! Hello? חייל, תשמע, תראה, זה היה פה, היה לנו פרויקט פה פעם, לפני זה, לפני שאתם נכנסתם. אני יכול להתקרב קצת?
לא.
למה אסור להתקרב? מה, זה רק שלכם המקום הזה? זה מקום של כולם, למה אתם בכלל פה? מי אתם שתהיו?
לא להתקדם.
למה?
ככה.
למה ככה?
ככה, אסור להתקדם.
זה הבית שלך, הצינור הזה? זה לא הבית שלך. אתה יושב פה בתוך צינור כזה ואומר לי מה לעשות, למה מה?
Doesn't he look ridiculous inside his pipe house? Like being the king of the hill inside his tube. My name is Eyal Weitzman. I am an architect. I'm a writer. I'm an activist. My work is to do with the intersection of architecture and violence. Architecture and the built environment is a kind of a slow violence. The occupation is an environment that slowly was conceived to strangulate Palestinian communities, villages and towns, to create an environment that would be unlivable for the people there. The crime was done on the drawing board itself. The settlements, which are here in blue, have been built like wedges, not only to serve the colonists themselves, but consciously to create material damage, cutting apart the very sort of fragile Palestinian built fabric. Architecture is used by architect as a weapon. We are looking at a battlefield, and the weapons and ammunitions of it are very simple elements. They are trees, they are terraces, they are houses, they are cladding, they are barriers. Everything in this panorama is a tactical tool within the architecture of occupation. Just need to know how to decode it. The first thing I want to show you is the neighborhood of Gilo. After 67, Israel annexes a large part of the West Bank and calls them Jerusalem, and immediately starts building remote neighborhoods there. These neighborhoods are called the Living Wall around the city. Immediately after the occupation, all of a sudden we see that. Buildings that make us feel like we're in the center of Jerusalem. In fact, we are miles away. Look actually at the corner of the buildings. An architect knows that we need to look at the corner of the building in order to study and see its construction. I see, that tells me that this is a concrete building, and that the stone is merely a veneer of 1.5 centimeter thick. So the government wanted to tell the people living here that they are living in part of the holy city of Jerusalem, and it was left for architecture to tell that story. The architectural principle of the Israeli occupation is a way of maintaining separation and exercising control. So this is the tunnel road built in 1996, now called the Apartheid Road, because they are roads that simply serve the Jewish communities, the Jewish colonies and settlements to the south of Jerusalem. We have a whole Jewish neighborhood overhead, and now we are driving over the Palestinian Valley. Settlements are built on hilltops, overlooking the Palestinian inner valleys between them. The main reason that they are built on hilltops is for their self-protection and for them to dominate the surrounding. So although Israel built hundreds and thousands of structures in the West Bank, the number of typologies is very limited. They're all variation on the single or double family houses with red roof, very suburban typology. In fact, red roof is something that is mandated by law, because this is allowing the military to navigate the landscape, to understand what's ours, what's there, what's friends, what's foe, where you can bomb and where not. You'd enter the house through the inner circuit, and you, as you move through the house, you open towards the view. The house itself is like an optical instrument, and when it is laid in rings around the hilltops, it is like a suburban scale optical device that can survey the entire territory around it. No way. No way, no. Ech, ech. מה יש לכם פה? את כל העולם. בונים לכם, את... יבנו לכם פה גדר ממול הבית, זה יערוס לכם את הנוף. עדיף לכם שלא יהיה גדר.
לא יודע.
מה אתה אומר? אבל הרי באת לפה בשביל הנוף.
באתי לפה בשביל הנוף, אבל כשאתה מתחיל לעשות שמיניות באוויר ולצאת מהעבודה באמצע ולהקפיץ את הילדים ולבקש שלא ייסעו באוטובוסים ושלם מוניות ולעשות הכל שיהיו לך שתי מכוניות למשל, כשאתה לא צריך שתי מכוניות, כל זה כדי שלא ייסעו באוטובוסים, וזה היה בתקופה שהאוטובוסים פה התפוצצו בירושלים.
כן.
אני לא החלטתי לשים את הגדר הזאת. אבל אני מרגיש יותר בטוח מאז שהיא נמצאת שם. כן.
When we think about borders, when we see even the wall, we imagine a single instrument that separates Israelis and Palestinians on two sides of a map. But actually, in the Israel-Palestine frontier, the border had splintered into various border devices. There are fences around the settlements, there are blockades around Palestinian cities, there are highways that operate as borders, there are checkpoints and sterile areas and all sort of other border devices that shrink and expand the terrain at will. To control a space, you need to create differentiation in speed of movement. When you put Israeli colonies on highways, you accelerate their movement through the space. In the same way, on every twist and turn of the terrain, Palestinians would encounter a border, a checkpoint, a fence, a valley that they cannot cross. Sometimes you can read politics on the most mundane of architectural elements. Turnstiles in Israel, when they put them as the most important instrument in checkpoints, they've reduced the arm of the turnstile for it to press against the body in case there is anything a person carries. But that creates horrific situations when people who are a little bit larger would get caught up within that turnstile. It's so cruel and degrading and reduces Palestinians to nothing more than bodies.
Yes, I remember that.
Yeah.
I was a child. We used to go there and play. But
yeah.
After they decide to take it, the land and do this street, we can't go there anymore.
So this is effectively the wall. It's just not a wall here, it's a fence.
Yes,
is,
we can't, yeah. We can't walk, we can't do anything here. If you notice that, it's surrounded by them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What is very cruel about this tower next to the wall is that they're designed to hide the presence of the army. So you'd always assume there's somebody looking at you. You see apartheid in action at this moment here. Conflict erupts, the slow violence of the environment is being put into immediate use. Israeli soldiers move down into Palestinian towns and villages from the settlements themselves. The checkpoint hardens and nobody can move through. The border completes around them, and the entire territory springs into use. In 2002, Sharon ordered the Israeli army to occupy the entirety of the West Bank as part of Operation Defensive Shield. They had no problem with the open areas, but invading the cities was somehow the most difficult part. We're now at the heart of the Jenin refugee camp. This is Palestinian ground zero. In 2002, the Israeli army tried to take hold of this camp, and then they've decided to enter the city by first using D9 bulldozers. The way they did it, really, is a kind of a design by destruction of the camp. They cut literally new streets through the dense urban fabric in order to allow the tanks to come in. The resistance retreated into the core of the camp, and at the end of the battle, effectively the bulldozers collapsed the heart of the camp on those fighters. It wasn't the first time that Israel used bulldozers, but it's the first time that the bulldozers were integrated into the battlefield. The fleet of bulldozers grew exponentially, and the bulldozers become really the means of Israeli fighting in Palestinian urban fabric. April 2002 attack on Jenin and Nablus was the laboratory for the US to think about the urban warfare in Iraq. And we're also training in Israeli training sites. It's kind of mock-up Arab cities that were built in a desert in the south. We are now in the city of Nablus. It was one of the biggest laboratories in 2002 for the development of a new type of urban warfare. Israelis were studying not only that city, but how cities operate. They understood in order to occupy the city, they need to invent and move in a city in a different manner. I started to study those tactics, which I thought were very architectural.
אם אני אנוע במבנה שמכתיבה צורת הרחוב, אני מגיש להם את יחידתי על מגע של כסף. מן הרגע הזה אתה אומר, רגע, 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 הם מחפשים מה שנקרא את חברתי. אני צריך לחשוב איך אני נותן להם שיעור שהם לא ישכחו. לא לנוע בחובות, לשאיר את החובות שוממים ונקיים. ובעצם להיכנס לבתים דרך קדיחת חורים בקירות.
What they're actually doing is they're turning private and public space upside down. The private space becomes a space of circulation. And the public space, the space of the street, is where the resistance fighters are being killed. Hello. Can I? Nasir Arafat is a Palestinian architect that lived through the Israeli invasion and is still in charge, 11 years later, on the ongoing project of reconstructing the city.
So that was the first invaded area, and then the troops came in and they surrounded the old city, and this is where the main destruction took place.
هذا محل الكهرباء.
Going through the old city at that time is like going through an earthquake where everything around you is demolished, the streets were full of rubbish. Now what's done here is a comprehensive restoration for one of the quarters that was badly affected by the invasion. Can you see the arrow there?
Yes.
This is what the Israeli soldiers have used in order to indicate to the other soldiers which way you should go.
عافية حجة. كيف حالك؟
Hello. Hello, how are you?
Yeah, so this lady is one of the living witnesses of what happened during the various invasions in the 8-year period,
right.
2008-2010.
She was smoking her water pipe. When the soldiers came from the wall,
and you were...
She was as if you speak it in English. Sorry to say that. She was telling him, "F off." Mm-hmm. And she continued smoking her water pipe. He went, and then the whole room behind her were blasted. But she didn't make a move. And she said, "Okay, I hope I will die, and I will be recorded on Guinness as the first one who was killed while smoking the water pipe in Nablus." So that was the story. I mean, you can see what it means to live in such a place.
بعدين هاي تراث.
الحمد لله بسلامتك حجة. هاي اللي بدي اخذها انا. هدية.
نحملها.
When violence is enacted through architecture, architecture must somehow rise to resist it. It must find the tools, and it must find those tools within its own toolbox. Now that most war take place in a city, that most war is urban warfare, architecture becomes really the most important evidence to read the contours of that violence. We can reconstruct the battle itself and what happened by looking very closely at the ruins. I gained the confidence of the EU to fund this project called Forensic Architecture to present architectural facts as evidence in legal and political forums. One of the major projects that we do is an analysis of drone warfare in Pakistan, Afghanistan, Yemen, Somalia, and Gaza.
Forensic Architecture are working with the mandate to look at particular strikes and to do, as far as we can, accurate reconstructions against which to assess the competing claims about the strikes themselves.
In Gaza during 2008-2009, the IDF started employing a kind of a tactics of warning. They were shooting a warning missile on the roof of buildings, waiting for about 3 minutes before they demolished the buildings completely. The Salha family is one of the saddest and most horrific instances where a new kind of warfare that tries to be legal, a kind of a humanitarian war, has gone completely wrong. Dear Mr. Fayez Salha and Mr. Noor Salha, thank you very much for coming here to speak to us. Our work has been actually an attempt to reconstruct what happened between the warning shot and the lethal shot. How a family gets organized, how they understand the options facing them. The family was trying to leave the house. They divided themselves into two groups.
أنا والأشخاص اللي كانوا معي تقريبا من هاي الناحية لا عند ممر خروج أو نزول على سلم البيت.
The second group, when it was just about to exit through the main door, the big bomb hit, demolished the building and killed 7 members of this family. Unpacking a situation like that is using a very particular story, the story of a family and the story of a house and the traces that we can see in this house to pose a kind of a political challenge to Israel's humanitarian war in Gaza. Your personal tragedy is enormous. It's also a part of the tragedy of the Palestinian people.
في حال أن تنال قضية عائلتي العدالة الدولية
I love this land and I care deeply about both peoples that live in here and I think looking at the landscape I see this kind of slow process of killing. I would have loved to practice my architecture free of the constraints and violence of this conflict, but I think that to be an architect is not only to build and to contribute to this destruction of the place that I love most, but to use architecture as a way to both interpret, protest, and resist.
Okay, thank you very much. Good evening. I just would like to start off by thanking all the student organizations that have invited us to this great event. And I would like just to say that I beg to differ with him about London having the biggest Israel apartheid event, because we have it in Gaza. And we do think that we have the biggest event in Gaza. But thank you so much for hosting me. This is my second time in London. I was here 2 years ago. I was also invited by comrades from IJAN, the International Jewish Anti-Zionist Network. And it's also an honor for me to be joining these great three Palestinian ladies. I am honored, and it is a turning point in my life to be seeing all of them here. Unfortunately, I mean, one thing that I would like to start off with is that I wouldn't be able to see these beautiful ladies in Gaza because of apartheid Israel. Israel would not allow any Palestinian from outside Gaza to visit the Gaza Strip. My sister lives in Bethlehem, which is a one-hour drive from Gaza. I haven't seen her since 2000. She has not been allowed to visit the Gaza Strip. I have not been allowed to visit Bethlehem. My parents' funeral took place in 2005, and she was not allowed to come and attend the funeral. That gives you an idea about the brutal system that we have to deal with in Palestine. I want to start also off with giving you an idea about the situation in Gaza, the deadly siege that has been imposed on Gaza since January 2006. And I want to allude a little bit to the BDS campaign. And then, although I have been warned not to talk about politics, but I want to talk about what I think is the most just political solution to the conflict in the Middle East. Conflict. I don't think it's a conflict, but I will allude to that at a later stage. But I want to take you back to January 2006, when we were asked. When I say we, I mean the Palestinians of the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. That is one third of the Palestinian people, because the Palestinian people have three components: those who live in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, and those who live in Israel, Palestine, 1948, and 7 million Palestinian refugees who live in the diaspora. The Palestinians of the Gaza Strip and the West Bank were asked to go to the polling station and vote for their representatives in the legislative council. We naively, Palestinians of the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, believed in the Bush doctrine in the Middle East of bringing democracy to the Middle East. So we went to the polling station. I didn't go. And I don't think that I will ever go to the polling station while Israel is still occupying the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, while Israel is still imposing apartheid laws against the indigenous population of Palestine, and before Israel implements United Nations Resolution 194, which clearly calls for the return of all Palestinian refugees. But about 60% of the residents of the Gaza Strip and the West Bank went to the polling station and voted against the will of the occupier. They voted against what the Americans wanted, and they voted against the two-state solution. They voted against the corruption of the Palestinian Authority. And they voted for the only available option then, which was Hamas. And because we voted against the peace industry, or rather those who went to the polling station voted against the peace industry, Israel, the United States of America, in cahoot with the European Union and Arab reactionary regime, including the dictator of Egypt, then Hosni Mubarak, decided to impose a deadly siege on the Gaza Strip, which is a form of collective punishment. And they started imposing the siege as soon as the elections took place and the results came out. We had no milk. We still have no milk for our children. No medicine. More than 178 kinds of essential medicines are not available in the Gaza Strip, including, I mean, cancer medicine, medicine for heart patients, kidney dialysis, etc. And I can go on and on and on. And we had no petrol, no electricity. Still we are suffering. And as if that was not enough, 2006, 2007, still the siege continued. The international community did absolutely nothing. And in fact, there has been an international conspiracy of silence. Palestinians of Gaza die while the world is watching. But we never surrendered. We never surrendered. And that's why, February, March 2008, the Israeli occupation forces decided to invade the northern part of the Gaza Strip, stayed there. Those who know Gaza, I'm talking about Jabalia refugee camp and Beit Hanun, stayed in the northern part of Gaza for 5 days. They wanted to test the water of the water of the international community. 5 days during which they killed 165 people, civilians, including 64 children. And the question was, on the streets of Gaza, well, what is the reaction of the international community? And when I say the international community, I'm referring to official bodies. I'm referring to governments, United Nations, Security Council, European Union, etc. And the reaction of the international community was absolutely nothing. Silence, i.e. complicity. Silence means complicity. And therefore, the Israelis understood very well that they could come back on the 27th of December, 2008, and carry out a massacre. On the first day of the massacre, on the 27th of December, 2008, the first 3 minutes of the massacre, about 270 Palestinian civilians were killed. The job was not done, and it was not enough. And that is why the Israelis continued for 22 days. The figure, and I hate to talk about figures and numbers, but I can't now mention every single name. 1,443 Palestinians were killed within 22 days, including 434 children. Now, Gaza had already been under medieval siege. Beit Salem, an Israeli mainstream Israeli human rights organization, called the Gaza Strip then the largest open-air prison. Richard Falk, Special Rapporteur, UN Special Rapporteur to the occupied territories, said it was a prelude to genocide. That was before 2008. Ilan Pappé, our friend and comrade Ilan Pappé, the courageous, conscientious Israeli historian and activist, called it slow genocide. But that was not enough. And that's why the Israelis wanted to continue, because the international community was silent. It's an international conspiracy of silence. On the 22nd day of the massacre, the Israelis decided to stop because of the inauguration of the new American president. Now, we expected the world to say something. I mean, the world in the 60s, 70s, and 80s endorsed the South African BDS call against the apartheid system of South Africa. Now, in Palestine, what we are witnessing is a multi-tiered system of oppression. Desmond Tutu, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, Ronnie Castles, anti-apartheid activist, told us that what we are witnessing right now in Palestine is far, far worse than what they had seen in South Africa under apartheid. Now, we looked at the South African experience, and we wanted to understand what made the world react, albeit late, in the late 80s, against crimes committed by the apartheid system. Apartheid is a crime against humanity. Everybody knows this. According to United Nations Resolution 1973, apartheid is a crime against humanity. And then we went back, we looked at the calls made by the anti-apartheid movement. The first call came out in 1950, here in London actually. You know, a group of anti-apartheid ANC activists came up with a call, BDS, calling on the international community to boycott apartheid South Africa, divest from it, and impose sanctions against it until it complies with international law. No political solutions. International law. Now, it took the international community more than 30 years to heed that call. The international community seems to be a bit slow. It took them about 30 years. And in the mid-80s, your Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan considered Nelson Mandela a terrorist. Margaret Thatcher talked about constructive engagement with the apartheid system. 1984-85. But by 1990, Nelson Mandela was released. So what happened? 1994, Nelson Mandela was elected as the first black president of multiracial South Africa. Anything wrong? Okay. 1994, he was elected as the first black president of multiracial South Africa. Now, in our case, Palestine, almost all Palestinian civil society organizations have endorsed our BDS call, which came out in 2005. In 2004, PACB, the Palestinian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel, was formed. Now, when the call came out in 2005, more than 170 organizations signed up. As I speak to you right now, I know very well that there is an overwhelming consensus around the issue of BDS. Almost all Palestinian civil society organizations and political organizations from extreme right to extreme left have endorsed the BDS call. Exactly like South Africa. The South Africans formed the UDF, the United Democratic Front. We have the Boycott National Committee, which includes everybody, representatives of all political organizations. Now, Israel, exactly like apartheid South Africa, considers the growing BDS campaign, initially it considered it a strategic threat. And now it is considering it as an existential threat against the state of Israel. That we, BDS activists, which means all Palestinians, want to destroy the state of Israel. Well, the BDS call against apartheid South Africa called for the destruction of the apartheid system, for the destruction of oppression, not the destruction of white presence in South Africa. The same thing. What we are calling for, I mean, three demands. Implementation of United Nations resolution, which calls for the withdrawal of Israeli troops from Arab lands that occupied in 1967, one. Two, an end to Israel's apartheid policies against the Palestinian citizens of the state of Israel, and end to apartheid. Three, implementation of United Nations resolution 194, which clearly calls for the return of about 7 million Palestinian refugees. Now, that is considered a call to end the state of Israel. Well, that is something that we can discuss. But again, still, the Israeli war machine, and I want to give you one piece of information. When Israel attacked Gaza in 2008, a poll conducted by Haaretz newspaper showed that 94% of Israeli Jews supported the attack on Gaza. But that was not enough. Killing 1,400, etc., was not enough. Ongoing siege, which has led so far to the death of more than 900 terminally ill people, that's not enough. And therefore, Israelis voted for the most fascist government in the history of the state of Israel. A government that has Benjamin Netanyahu and Avigdor Lieberman. Avigdor Lieberman, for those who don't know, openly calls for the ethnic cleansing of Palestine, euphemistically called transfer. Ethnic cleansing of Palestine. People went to the polling stations and voted for Avigdor Lieberman. And therefore, exactly like what happened in South Africa, in 1985, 75% of white South Africans voted NP, National Party, voted for apartheid. But in 1994, the same percentage voted against apartheid. So what happened? It is BDS. It's the BDS call. Because the blacks of South Africa, exactly like the Palestinians of Palestine, had the what Edward Said called the higher moral ground. And we have the higher moral ground here. I mean, justice. That is what we are calling for. We are calling for justice, implementation of United Nations resolutions pertaining to the question of Palestine. And as I said, what happened in 2008-2009 was not enough. And of course, Avigdor Lieberman cannot leave the most fascist government in the history of the State of Israel without leaving a mark on the consciousness of the Palestinian people. And that is why they came back in November 2012. 1 week during which they killed more than 190 civilians, including 65 children. Of course, injuring more than 5,500 people. We have not surrendered. We have not given up. For us, existence on the land of Palestine, and when I say Palestine, I'm referring to 1948 and I'm referring to 1967. Existence for us is resistance. They want to drive us away of the Gaza Strip, push us into the Sinai Desert. We are not doing that. We are not repeating the Nakba again. We will not leave the Gaza Strip. We will not leave the West Bank. In fact, I think what we are going through right now is a turning point. It's a turning point because we have learned. We have learned from our own history, and we have learned from the history of the struggle in South Africa, in Algeria, and other colonial states and countries. And what we are saying right now is that Israel has shot the two-state solution in the head. And when I say two-state solution, I have never personally, and I know that I'm being politically incorrect now, because I'm talking about political solutions, but after Gaza 2008 and 2009, actually, I don't care. I don't care at all. Because Palestinians of Gaza and the West Bank are fed up. They're fed up with this international conspiracy of silence, with people watching children dying on the streets of Gaza. I mean, what does it take? What more than the amputated bodies of the children of Gaza does it take the international community to do something? And meanwhile, what we are saying is that every individual has a moral responsibility. We refuse to buy things made in apartheid South Africa in the 70s and 80s as individuals. I'm not talking now about collective responsibility, individual responsibility. And I think that you have a moral responsibility. We have the higher moral ground here as the Palestinians, and what we are asking you is to boycott apartheid Israel. We want equality. We want justice. Now, if we want to follow the logic of the supremacists in Palestine, Israel, South Africa, well, we don't have the right to exist. Golda Meir in 1967, so when she was asked about Palestinians, she said, Who are they? They don't exist. And what I'm saying is that our existence is resistance. And we think, and now I'm taking off the hat of the BDS activist and putting on the hat of the one state activist, that now Israel has shot the two-state solution in the head. So for practical reasons, I don't think that it will be possible to have a sovereign, independent Palestinian state on 22% of the historic land of Palestine, i.e. the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. Israel has redeployed its troops around the Gaza Strip and transformed it into the largest concentration camp on earth. And Israel has expropriated more than 54% of the land of the West Bank, Greater Jerusalem, existing settlements. And by the way, for those who display ignorance, those racists who display ignorance and don't like to hear these figures, when the dovish government of the Labour Party of Israel decided to sign the Oslo Accords in 1993, the number of Jewish settlers in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank was 193,000. Now, the number of Jewish settlers in the West Bank alone, because no settlements in the Gaza Strip, has risen to 600,000. And when I say settlements, I'm not talking about outposts there and here. I'm talking about cities and towns, by the way. And these settlements are, we are not allowed to visit these settlements. We are not allowed to drive on the roads, the zigzag roads leading to these settlements. So yes, in the West Bank there is apartheid. In Gaza Strip, which is the largest concentration camp on earth, we cannot leave the Gaza Strip. I told you I haven't seen my sister since 2000. But I'm also referring to the apartheid system implemented in Palestine in 1948 against Abir Qubti. I'm not talking about now the direct military occupation of the West Bank, the besieging of the Gaza, and even the apartheid system in Israel itself. Israel doesn't define itself as the state of its citizens, by the way, for those who insist on displaying ignorance. White South Africa was for whites only. White democracy. Israel is a Jewish state, the state of Jews all over the world. Not my state, not her state. And there are question marks here to be asked. There are questions to be asked. And I think if you have the minimum of morality and humanity, you should consider boycotting apartheid Israel until it complies with international law. That's what we're asking for. And the one-state solution, again, going back to my role as a one-state activist, is a compromise, a generous compromise from the colonized victim offered to the colonialist, to the supremacist, who's decided to come and settle in Palestine. We are offering him or her to share the land of Palestine together. And I think Gaza, and I want to finish now, I'm sure that you are furious with me. Gaza 2008-2009, as I said once, was the Sharpeville of the Middle East, with reference to the Sharpeville massacre in South Africa in 1960, which was a turning point in the struggle against apartheid. And I'm saying now that Gaza 2012 is the Soweto of the Middle East. The Soweto Intifada, the Soweto uprising that took place in 1977, was the beginning of the end of the apartheid system and oppression in South Africa. And I know very well, as a fact, that Gaza 2012 is the turning point that will ultimately lead to the destruction of apartheid in Palestine and the establishment of a secular democratic state on the historic land of Palestine. Thank you so much.
And this concludes another edition of This Week in Palestine, a weekly segment here on 90.3 FM Newton that is part of Truth and Justice Radio, heard every Sunday from 6 to 10 a.m. We hope you'll join us again for news and views from and about Palestine.